With continual development in technology, hackers and cybercriminals are getting better and better at installing viruses and hacking your electronic devices. We've all had antivirus software, but your run-of-the-mill software just isn't good enough anymore. With Surfshark Antivirus, not only will you have antivirus scans and real-time virus protection, but you'll also have access to a VPN. You'll be protected from targeted ads and tracking. You'll be notified if your data gets leaked by data brokers. And most importantly, it's incredibly easy to set up and use. If you feel like your online protection should be better, use the link in the description and episode notes to get 76% off Surfshark Antivirus today and feel safe every day on your devices. I live in Europe, and it's incredibly easy to travel here. By bus, train, or plane, I can be in any other European country in a matter of hours, for pretty cheap. But while I'm in other countries, I still want to check my emails, check my YouTube analytics, and all that fun stuff. Well, by using Surfshark VPN, I changed my location to France using one of their 3,200-plus servers, and I'm no longer annoyed by thousands of emails from Google freaking out saying, "Oh my god, there's a computer in Spain trying to hack you!" There isn't Google. It's me. And thanks to Surfshark, I'm no longer bothered by these annoying messages. Use the link in the description or episode notes to get Surfshark VPN today for as little as $2.30 per month on a 2-year plan, and log into all your accounts anywhere with zero hassle and no annoying emails.
Hello, and welcome to The Essential Reads. My name is Isaac, and my goal is to bring you a bunch of classic audiobooks in an easy and accessible way. Let's get started. This podcast is brought to you by my store. I will publish all my audiobooks in podcast format here, but if you really want to support me in making these or just want to listen to them when disconnected from the internet, then you can buy my audiobooks for $5 at theessentialreads.myshopify.com. The link will be in the description. Thank you. Dracula by Bram Stoker. Chapter 9. Letter Mina Harker to Lucy Westenra, Budapest, 24 August.
My dearest Lucy, I know you will be anxious to hear all that has happened since we passed at the railway station at Whitby. Well, my dear, I got to Hull all right and caught the boat to Hamburg and then the train on here. I feel I can hardly recall anything of the journey, except that I knew I was coming to Jonathan, and that, as I should have to do some nursing, had better get all the sleep I could. I found my dear one, oh, so thin, and pale and weak-looking. All the resolution has gone out of his dear eyes, and that quiet dignity which I told you was in his face has vanished. He is only a wreck of himself, and he does not remember anything that has happened to him for a long time past. At least, he wants me to believe so, and I shall never ask. He has had some terrible shock, and I fear it might tax his poor brain if he were to try and recall it. Sister Agatha, who is a good creature, and a born nurse, tells me that he raved of dreadful things whilst he was off his head. I wanted her to tell me what they were, but she would only cross herself and say that she would never tell, that ravings of the sick were the secrets of God, and that if a nurse, through her vocation, should hear them, she should respect her trust. She is a sweet and good soul, and the next day, when she saw I was troubled, she opened up the subject again, and, after saying that she could never mention what my poor dear raved about, added, "I can tell you this much, my dear, that it was not about anything which he has done wrong himself, and you, as his wife-to-be, have no cause to be concerned. He has not forgotten you or what he owes you. His fear was of great and terrible things which no mortal can treat of." I believe the poor soul thought I might be jealous lest my poor dear should have fallen in love with any other girl. The idea of my being jealous about Jonathan! Yet, my dear, let me whisper, I felt a thrill of joy through me when I knew that no other woman was a cause of trouble. I am now sitting by his bedside where I can see his face while he sleeps. He is waking. When he woke, he asked me for his coat, as he wanted to get something from his pocket. I asked Sister Agatha and she brought all his things. I saw amongst them was his notebook, and I was going to ask him to let me look at it, for I knew then that I might find some clue about his trouble. But I suppose he must have seen my wish in my eyes, for he sent me over to the window, saying he wanted to be quite alone for a moment. Then he called me back, and when I came, he had his hand over the notebook, and he said to me very solemnly, "Wilhelmina." I knew then that he was in deadly earnest, for he has never called me by that name since he asked me to marry him. "You know, dear, my ideas of the trust between husband and wife. There should be no secret, no concealment. I have had a great shock, and when I try to think of what it is, I feel my head spin round, and I do not know if it was all real or the dreaming of a madman. You know I have had brain fever, and that it is to be mad. The secret is here, and I do not want to know it. I want to take up my life here, with our marriage. For, my dear, we had decided to be married as soon as the formalities are complete. Are you willing, Wilhelmina, to share my ignorance? Here is the book. Take it and keep it. Read it if you will, but never let me know, unless, indeed, some solemn duty should come upon me to go back to the bitter hours, asleep or awake, sane or mad, recorded here." He fell back, exhausted, and I put the book under his pillow and kissed him. "I have asked Sister Agatha to beg the Superior to let our wedding be this afternoon, and I am waiting her reply. She's come and told me that the chaplain of the English Mission Church has been sent for. We are to be married in an hour, or as soon after as Jonathan wakes. Lucy, the time has come and gone. I feel very solemn, but very, very happy." Jonathan woke a little after the hour, and was all ready, and sat up in bed, propped up with pillows. He answered his "I will," firmly and strongly. I could hardly speak. My heart was so full that even these words seemed to choke me. The dear sisters were so kind. Please God, I shall never, never forget them, nor the grave and sweet responsibilities I have taken upon me. I must tell you of my wedding present. When the chaplain and the sisters had left me alone with my husband, oh, Lucy, it's the first time that I have written the words "my husband." Left me alone with my husband. I took the book from under his pillow and wrapped it up in white paper and tied it with a little bit of pale blue ribbon which was wound round my neck, and sealed it over the knot with sealing wax. And for my seal, I used my wedding ring. Then I kissed it and showed it to my husband, and told him that I would keep it so, and then it would be an outward and visible sign for us, all our lives, that we trusted each other, that I would never open it unless it were for his own dear sake, or for the sake of some stern duty. Then he took my hand in his, and, Lucy, it was the first time he took his wife's hand, and said that it was the dearest thing in the wide world, and that he would go through all the past again to win it, if need be. The poor dear meant to have said a part of the past, but he cannot think of time yet, and I shall not wonder if at first he mixes up not only the month, but the year. Well, my dear, what could I say? I could only tell him that I was the happiest woman in the wide world, and that I had nothing to give him except myself, my life, and my trust, and that with these went my love and duty for all the days of my life. And, my dear, when he kissed me and drew me to him with his poor weak hands, it was like a very solemn pledge between us. Lucy, dear, do you know why I tell you all this? It is not only because it is all sweet to me, but because you have been, and are, very dear to me. It was my privilege to be your friend and guide when you came from the schoolroom to prepare for the world of life. I want you to see now, and with the eyes of a very happy wife, whither duty has led me, so that, in your own married life, you too may be all happy as I am. My dear, please, Almighty God, your life may be all it promises, a long day of sunshine, with no harsh wind, no forgetting duty, no distrust. I must not wish you no pain, for that can never be, and I do hope you will be always as happy as I am now. Goodbye, my dear. I shall post this at once, and perhaps write you very soon again. I must stop, for Jonathan is waking. I must attend to my husband. Your ever-loving, Mina Harker.
Letter. Lucy Wistenra to Mina Harker. Whitby, 30th of August.
My dearest Mina, oceans of love and millions of kisses, and may you soon be in your own home with your husband. I wish that you could be coming home soon enough to stay with us here. This strong air would soon restore Jonathan. It's quite restored me. I have an appetite like a cormorant, am full of life, and sleep well. You will be glad to know that I have quite given up my walking in my sleep. I think I have not stirred out of my bed for a week, that is, when I once got into it at night. Arthur says that I am getting fat. By the way, I forgot to tell you that Arthur is here. We have such walks and drives and rides and rowing and tennis and fishing together. And I love him more than ever. He tells me that he loves me more, but I doubt that. For at first he told me that he couldn't love me more than he did then, but this is nonsense. There he is, calling to me. So, no more just at present. From your loving, Lucy. P.S. Mother sends her love. She seems to be better, poor dear. P.P.S. We're to be married on the 28th of September.
Dr. Seward's Diary. 20th August. The case of Renfield grows even more interesting. He is now so far quieted that there are spells of secession from his passion. For the first week after his attack, he was perpetually violent. Then, one night, just as the moon rose, he grew quiet and kept murmuring to himself, "Now I can wait. Now I can wait." The attendant came to tell me, so I ran down at once to have a look at him. He was still in the straight waistcoat and in the padded room, but the surfeit look had gone from his face, and his eyes had something of their old pleading. I might almost say cringing softness. I was satisfied with his present condition and directed him to be relieved. The attendants hesitated, but finally carried out my wishes without protest. It was a strange thing that the patient had humour enough to see their distrust, for, coming close to me, he said in a whisper, all the while looking furtively at them, "They think I could hurt you. Fancy me hurting you, the fools." It was soothing, somehow, to the feelings, to find myself dissociated, even in the mind of this poor madman from the others. But, all the same, I do not follow his thought. Am I to take it that I have anything in common with him, so that we are, as it were, to stand together? Or has he to gain from me some good so stupendous that my well-being is needful to him? I must find out later on. Tonight, he will not speak. Even the offer of a kitten or a fully grown cat will not tempt him. He will only say, "I don't take any stock in cats. I have more to think of now, and I can wait. I can wait." After a while, I left him. The attendant tells me that he was quiet until just before dawn. And then he began to get uneasy, and at length, violent, until at last he fell into a paroxysm, which exhausted him, so that he swooned into a sort of coma. 3 nights has the same thing happened, violent all day, then quiet from moonrise to sunrise. Wish I could get some clue to the cause. It would almost seem as if there were some influence which came and went. Happy thought! We shall, tonight, play sane wits against mad ones. He escaped before without our help. Tonight, he shall escape with it. We shall give him a chance and have the men ready to follow in case they are required. 23rd of August. The unexpected always happens. How well Disraeli knew life. Our bird, when he found the cage open,
would not fly. So, all our subtle arrangements went for naught. At any rate, we have proved one thing. That the spells of quietness last a reasonable time. We shall, in future, be able to ease his bonds for a few hours each day. I have given orders to the attendant merely to shut him in the padded room, when once he is quiet until an hour before sunrise. The poor soul's body will enjoy the relief, even if his mind cannot appreciate it. Hark! The unexpected again! I'm called. The patient has once more escaped. Later. Another night adventure. Renfield artfully waited until the attendant was entering the room to inspect. Then he dashed out past him and flew down the passage. I sent word for the attendants to follow. Again, he went into the grounds of the deserted house, and we found him in the same place, pressed against the old chapel door. When he saw me, he became furious, and had not the attendant seized him in time, he would have tried to kill me. As we were holding him, a strange thing happened. He suddenly redoubled his efforts, and then, as suddenly, grew calm. I looked round instinctively, but could see nothing. Then I caught the patient's eye and followed it, but could trace nothing as it looked into the moonlit sky except a big bat which was flapping its silent, ghostly way to the west. Bats usually wheeled and flit about, but this one seemed to go straight on, as if it knew where it was bound for, or had some intentions of its own. The patient grew calmer every instant, and presently said, "You needn't tie me. I shall go quietly." Without trouble, we came back to the house. I feel there is something ominous in his calm, and shall not forget this night. Lucy Westenra's Diary. Hillingham, 24th August. I must imitate Mina, and keep writing things down. Then we can have long talks when we do meet. I wonder when it will be. I wish you were here with me again, for I feel so unhappy. Last night, I seemed to be dreaming again, just as I was at Whitby. Perhaps it is the change of air, or getting home again. It is all dark and horrid to me, for I can remember nothing, but I am full of vague fear, and feel so weak and worn out. When Arthur came to lunch, he looked quite grieved when he saw me, and I hadn't the spirit to be cheered. I wonder if I could sleep in Mother's room tonight. I shall make an excuse and try. 25th August. Another bad night. Mother did not seem to take to my proposal. She seemed not too well herself, and doubtless she fears to worry me. I tried to keep awake, and succeeded for a while, but when the clock struck 12, it waked me from a doze, so I must have been falling asleep. There was a sort of scratching or flapping at the window, but I did not mind it. And, as I remember no more, I suppose I must then have fallen asleep. More bad dreams. I wish I could remember them. This morning, I am horribly weak. My face is ghastly pale, and my throat pains me. It must be something wrong with my lungs, for I don't seem to ever get enough air. I shall try to cheer up when Arthur comes, or else I know he shall be miserable to see me so. Letter. Arthur Homewood to Dr. Seward. Albanale Hotel, 31st of August. My dear Jack, I want you to do me a favour. Lucy is ill. That is, she has no special disease, but she looks awful, and is getting worse every day. I have asked her if there's any cause. I do not care to ask her mother, for to disturb the poor lady's mind about her daughter in her present state of health would be fatal. Mrs. Westenra has confided to me that her doom is spoken, disease of the heart. Though poor Lucy does not know it yet. I am sure that there is something preying on my dear girl's mind. I am almost distracted when I think of her. To look at her gives me a pang. I told her I should ask you to see her, and, though she demurred at first, I know why, old fellow, she finally consented. It will be a painful task for you, I know, old friend, but it is for her sake, and I must not hesitate to ask, or you to act. You are to come to lunch at Hillingham tomorrow, 2 o'clock, so as not to arouse any suspicion in Mrs. Westenra. And, after lunch, Lucy will take an opportunity of being alone with you. I shall come in for tea, and we can go away together. I am filled with anxiety, and want to consult with you alone as soon as I can after you have seen her. Do not fail. Arthur. Telegram. Arthur Holmwood to Seward. September 1st. Am summoned to see my father, who is worse. Am writing. Write me fully by tonight's post to ring. Wire me if necessary. Letter from Dr. Seward to Arthur Holmwood. 2nd of September. My dear old fellow. With regard to Miss Westenra's health, I hasten to let you know at once that, in my opinion, there is not any functional disturbance, or any malady that I know of. At the same time, I'm not by any means satisfied with her appearance. She is woefully different from what she was when I last saw her. Of course, you must bear in mind that I did not have full opportunity of examination, such as I should wish. Our very friendship makes a little difficulty, which not even medical science or custom can bridge over. I'd better tell you exactly what happened, leaving you to draw, in a measure, your own conclusion. I shall then say what I have done and propose doing. I found Miss Westenra in seemingly gay spirits. Her mother was present, and in a few seconds I made up my mind that she was trying all she knew to mislead her mother and prevent her from being anxious. I have no doubt she guesses, if she does not know, what need of caution there is. We lunched alone, and as we all exerted ourselves to be cheerful, we got, in some kind of reward for our labours, some real cheerfulness among us. Then Mrs. Westenra went to lie down, and Lucy was left with me. We went into her boudoir, and till we got there, her gaiety remained, for the servants were coming and going. As soon as the door was closed, however, the mask fell from her face, and she sank down in a chair with a great sigh, and hid her eyes with her hand. When I saw that her high spirits had failed, I at once took advantage of her reaction to make a diagnosis. She said to me, very sweetly, "I cannot tell you how I loathe talking about myself." I reminded her that a doctor's confidence was sacred, but that you were grievously anxious about her. She caught on to my meaning at once, and settled the matter in a word. "Tell Arthur everything you choose. I do not care for myself, but all for him. So I am quite free." I could easily see that she is somewhat bloodless, but could not see the usual anemic signs, and by a chance I was actually able to test the quality of her blood, for in opening a window, which was stiff, a cord gave way and she cut her hand with slightly broken glass. It was a slight matter in itself, but it gave me an evident chance, and I secured a few drops of blood and have analysed them. The qualitative analysis gives a quite normal condition and shows, I should infer, in itself, a vigorous state of health. In other physical matters, I was quite satisfied that there is no need for anxiety, but as there must be a cause somewhere, I've come to the conclusion that it must be something mental. She complains of breathing satisfactorily at times, and of heavy, lethargic sleep, with dreams that frighten her, but regarding which she can remember nothing. She says that as a child she used to walk in her sleep, and that when in Whitby, the habit came back, and that once she walked out in the night and went off to the East Cliff, where Miss Murray found her. But she assures me that of late the habit has not returned. I am in doubt, and so have done the best thing I know of. I have written to my old friend and master, Professor Van Helsing of Amsterdam, who knows as much about obscure diseases as anyone in the world. I have asked him to come over, and as you told me that all things were to be at your charge, I have mentioned to him who you are and your relations to Miss Westenra. This, my dear fellow, is only in obedience to your wishes, for I am only too proud and happy to do anything I can for her. Van Helsing would, I know, do anything for me, for a personal reason. So, no matter on what ground he comes, we must accept his wishes. He is a seemingly arbitrary man, but this is because he knows what he is talking about better than anyone else. He is a philosopher and a metaphysician, and one of the most advanced scientists of his day. And he has, I believe, an absolutely open mind. This, with an iron nerve, a temper of the ice brook, an indomitable resolution, self-command, and toleration exalted from virtues to blessings, and the kindest and truest heart that beats, these form his equipment for the noble work that he is doing for mankind. Work, both in theory and practice, for his views are as wide as his all-embracing sympathy. I tell you these facts that you may know why I have such confidence in him. I've asked him to come at once. I shall see Miss Westenra tomorrow, again. She is to meet me at the stores, so that I may not alarm her mother by too early repetition of my call. Yours always, Jonathan Seward. Letter to Abraham Van Helsing, MD, DPH, DLit, etc., etc., to Dr. Seward. 2nd of September. My good friend, when I have received your letter, I am already coming to you. By good fortune, I can leave just at once, without wrong to any of those who have trusted me. Were fortune other, then it were bad for those who have trusted, for I come to my friend when he calls me to aid those who he holds dear. Tell your friend that when that time you shuck from my wound so swiftly the poison of the gangrene from that knife that our other friend, too nervous, let slip, you did more for him than he wants my aid, and you call for him, than all his great fortunes could do. But it is pleasure added to do for him, your friend. It is to you that I come. Have then rooms for me at the Great Eastern Hotel, so that I may be near at hand, and please it so arranged that we may see the young lady not too late on tomorrow, for it is likely that I may have to return here that night. But if need be, I shall come again in 3 days, and stay longer if it must. Till then, goodbye, my friend, John. Van Helsing. Letter, Dr. Seward to Honourable Arthur Holmwood. 3 September. My dear Art, Van Helsing has come and gone. He came on with me to Hillingham, and found that, by Lucy's discretion, her mother was lunching out, so that we were alone with her. Van Helsing made a very careful examination of the patient. He is to report to me, and I shall advise you, for, of course, I was not present all the time. He is, I fear, much concerned, but says he must think. When I told him of our friendship, and how you trust me in the matter, he said, "You must tell him all you think. Tell him what I think, if you can guess it, if you will. Nay, I am not jesting. This is no jest, but life and death, perhaps more." I asked what he meant by that, for he was very serious. This was when we had come back to town, and he was having a cup of tea before starting on his return to Amsterdam. He would not give me any further clue. You must not be angry with him, Art, because his very reticence means that all his brains are working for her good. He will speak plainly enough when the time comes, be sure. So I told him I would simply write an account of our visit, just as if I were doing a descriptive special article for the Daily Telegraph. He seemed not to notice, but remarked that the smuts in London were not quite so bad as they used to be when he was a student here. I am to get a report tomorrow, if he can possibly make it. In any case, I am to have a letter. Well, as to the visit, Lucy was more cheerful than on the day I first saw her, and certainly looked better. She had lost something of the ghastly look that so upset you, and her breathing was normal. She was very sweet to the professor, as she always is, and tried to make him feel at ease, though I could see that the poor girl was making a hard struggle for it. I believe Van Helsing saw it, too, for I saw the quick look under his bushy brows that I knew of old. Then he began to chat of all things except ourselves and disease, and with such an infinite geniality that I could see poor Lucy's pretense of animation merge into reality. Then, without any seeming change, he brought the conversation gently round to his visit, and suavely said, "My dear young miss, I have so great the pleasure because you are so much beloved." "That is much, my dear, even word of that which I do not see. They told me that you were in despair, and that you are ghastly pale. To them, I say poof." And then he snapped his fingers at me, and went on, "But you and I shall show them how wrong they are." "How can he?" And he pointed at me with the same look and gesture as that with which once he pointed me out to his class, on, or rather after, a particular occasion which he never fails to remind me of. "Know anything of a young lady's? He has his madmen to play with, and to bring them back to happiness, and to those that love them. It is much to do, and, Oh, but there are rewards, in that we can bestow such happiness. But the young ladies! He has no wife nor daughter, and the young do not tell themselves to the young, but to the old, like me, who have known so many sorrows and the causes of them. So, my dear, we will send him away to smoke a cigarette in the garden, while you and I have a little talk to ourselves. I took the hint and strolled about, and, presently, the professor came to the window and called me in. I have made careful examination, but there is no functional cause. With you, I agree that there has been much blood loss. It has been, but is not. But the conditions of her are in no way anemic. I've asked her to send me her maid, that I may just ask one or two questions, so that I may not chance to miss nothing. I know well what she will say, and yet there is cause. There is always cause for everything. I must go back home and think. You must send to me the telegram every day, and if there be cause, I shall come again. The disease, for not to be all well is a disease, interests me, and the sweet young dear, she interests me too. She charmed me, and for her, if not for you or disease, I come. As I tell you, he would not say a word more, even when we were alone. And so now, Art, you know all I know. I shall keep stern watch. I trust your poor father is rallying. It must be a terrible thing to you, my dear old fellow, to be placed in such a position between two people who are both so dear to you. I know your idea of duty to your father, and you are right to stick to it. But, if need be, I shall send you word to come at once to Lucy. So do not be over-anxious unless you hear from me. Dr. Seward's Diary. Zophagus' patient still keeps our interest in him. He had only one outburst, and that was yesterday, at an unusual time. Just before the stroke of noon, he began to grow restless. The attendant knew the symptoms, and at once summoned aid. Fortunately, the men came at a run, and were just in time, for at the stroke of noon he became so violent that it took all of their strength to hold him. In about 5 minutes, however, he began to get more and more quiet, and finally sank into a sort of melancholy, in which state he has remained up until now. The attendant tells me that his screams, whilst in the paroxysm, were really appalling. I found my hands full when I got in, attending to some of the other patients who were frightened by him. Indeed, I can quite understand the effect, for the sounds disturbed even me, though I was some distance away. It is now after the dinner hour of the asylum, and, as yet, my patient sits in the corner, brooding, with a dull, sullen, woebegone look in his face, which seems rather to indicate than to show something directly. I cannot quite understand it. Later. Another change in my patient. At 5 o'clock, I looked in on him, and found him seemingly as happy and contented as he used to be. He was catching flies and eating them, and was keeping note of his capture by making small nail marks on the edge of the door between the ridges and the padding. When he saw me, he came over and apologised for his bad conduct, and asked me, in a very humble, cringing way, to be led back to his own room and have his notebook again. I thought it well to humour him, so he is back in his room with the window open. He has the sugar for his tea spread out on the windowsill, and is reaping quite a harvest of flies. He is not now eating them, but putting them in a box, as of old, and is already examining the corners of his room to find a spider. I tried to get him to talk about the past few days, for any clue to his thoughts would be an immense help to me, but he would not rise. For a moment or two, he looked very sad, and in a sort of faraway voice, as though saying it rather to himself than to me, "All over. All over. He's deserted me. No hope for me now, unless I do it for myself." Then, suddenly, turning to me in a resolute way, he said, "Doctor, won't you be very good and let me have a little more sugar? I think it would be good for me." "And the flies?" I said. "Yes, the flies like it too. And I like the flies. Therefore, I like it." And there are people who know so little as to think that madmen do not argue. I procured him a double supply, and left him as happy a man as, I suppose, any in the world. I wish I could fathom his mind. Midnight. Another change in him. I'd been to see Miss Westenra, whom I found much better, and had just returned, and was standing at our own gate, looking at the sunset, when, once more, I heard him yelling. As his room is on the side of the house, I could hear him better than in the morning. It was a shock to me to turn from the wonderful smoky beauty of a sunset over London, with its lurid lights and inky shadows and all the marvellous tints that come on foul clouds, even as on foul water, and to realise all the grim sternness of my own cold stone building, with its wealth of breathing misery, and my own desolate heart to endure it all. I reached him just as the sun was going down, and from his window saw the red disk sink. As it sank, he became less and less frenzied, and just as it dipped, he slid from the hands that held him, an inert mass on the floor. It is wonderful, however, what intellectual recuperative power lunatics have, for within a few minutes he stood up, quite calmly, and looked around him. I signalled to the attendants not to hold him, for I was anxious to see what he would do. He went straight over to the window and brushed out the crumbs of sugar. Then he took his fly box and emptied it outside, and threw away the box. Then he shut the window, and, crossing over, sat down on his bed. All this surprised me. So I asked him, "Are you not going to keep flies any more?" "No," said he. "I'm sick of all that rubbish." He certainly is a wonderfully interesting study. I wish I could get some glimpse of his mind, or of the cause of his sudden passion. Stop. There may be some clue after all, if we can find why today Hisproxim came on at high noon and at sunset. Can it be that there is a malign influence of the sun at periods which affect certain natures, as at times the moon does others? We shall see. Telegram, Seaward, London, to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. 4th September. Patient still better today. Telegram, Seaward, London, to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. 5th September. Patient greatly improved. Good appetite. Sleeps naturally. Good spirits. Colour coming back. Telegram, Seaward, London, to Van Helsing, Amsterdam. 6th September. Terrible change for the worse. Come at once. Do not lose an hour. I hold over telegram to Holmwood till I have seen you. Thank you so very much for listening. If you enjoyed, please like, comment, share, all that jazz. And if you really enjoyed, do subscribe because there's more to come. And if you're listening on podcast, please leave a review. It would really mean the absolute world to me. And it would help get this in front of as many people as possible, which would be brilliant. So if you do that, I would be so, so grateful. Once again, thank you for listening. And until next time, bye-bye.